The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing this show. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you are free to do so. Just send us an email so we know that you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website at firestorm.coop.
This week, we are partially featuring a conversation with NYC Antifa, an anti-fascist group in New York City, about the fast-approaching International Day of Solidarity with Anti-Fascist Prisoners on July 25th. We speak about the history of this day and about the current state of fascist activity in the U.S. and abroad. This conversation was transcribed and re-recorded to protect the folks' identities. You can see more about this day by visiting nycantifa.wordpress.com, or you can donate to the Defense Fund, International Defense Fund, by visiting intlantifadefense.wordpress.com/about-2. The longer segment of this episode is a conversation with members of Keep Hoods Yours, an anti-authoritarian, anti-gentrification, anti-sexist, anti-racist, and so forth graffiti crew based in the San Francisco Bay Area. We'll talk about organizing in youth culture, radical potentials in graffiti, some of the struggles that KHY has been involved in, and more. Thanks to our West Coast office and people in bear suits for making this conversation happen. Also on July 25th at 9 a.m., Luke O'Donovan will walk out of Washington State Prison after serving 2 years there. We at his support site are thrilled to see our friend released from behind prison walls. He is in high spirits and very excited to be released. As many of you who have been in touch with him know, he has occupied his time with a rigorous workout routine, lots of reading, and correspondence with all those who took the time to communicate with him. Unfortunately, he will not be allowed to return to his home and life in Atlanta. Due to the judge adding a banishment condition to his probation, Luke will have to move all the way to the West Coast for the next 8 years, or until the conditions of his probation are changed. Moving forward, here are some ways to continue to support Luke as he starts life on a strict probation. Money. Luke will need money in order to cover his living expenses while he gets on his feet and moves his belongings and life to the West Coast. He will also need money to cover the probation and drug testing fees that he will be subject to. You can donate or set up recurring donations, and we will have that link up on our blog at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. Care packages. Luke will need lots of little things like clothes to rebuild his wardrobe, delicious vegan food, and other items that you are not allowed to have in prison. If you would like to send a care package, please email letlukego@gmail.com to work out details on where and what to send. Solidarity and support. Throughout Luke's case and subsequent imprisonment and support, the support and solidarity he has gotten has been overwhelming. From the solidarity marches and actions to the mountain of mail and the hundreds of postcards sent to the judge, we have been thrilled by all of those who have taken action for him. Once things are more clear, we will begin trying to get his banishment condition appealed. Check back for updates. For now, any and all actions are appreciated. As Luke's new living situation isn't worked out yet, we can't provide contact info at this time, but email us at letlukego@gmail.com if you want to get in touch. Luke is set to be free from prison, but there is still a lot to do. Thanks, everyone, for your past and future support. But first, some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
I've never understood the obsession with regulating other people's sexual behavior. It sure seems like we live in a world where most people are more concerned about what other people are doing with their pants down than they are about what they themselves are going to do with their own pants down. I've never had that luxury, I guess. I've got a face for radio. I've always had to focus intensely on my own options for sexual activity whenever they fall into my lap. That means two things. It's never occurred to me that I should concern myself with the genital friction that others create or with whom they create it, or by what means. So long as it's consensual and no animals are harmed, what's the big deal? Maybe it's a hierarch thing. I don't know. Here's my thinking. Consider the person you imagine to be the most sexually active human you know. How many hours per day does that particular specimen spend in flinging DNA? If we average it out, figuring in the days with no activity over the course of a lifetime, and we average it up, does even the most active of us spend more than an hour a day creating protein puddles? I don't think so. I would suggest to you that we spend more of our time over the course of our lifetimes eating than we spend flinging DNA.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
So shouldn't we be more concerned regulating how people eat? It seems to me that by the logic of the sex police, we should have some strict social mores related to eating more so than sex. And we should have serious consequences for violating those mores. In a rational world, we'd care more about whether people are chewing with their mouths open or using a salad fork on their main course than we'd care about the gender of their sex partners or the placement of their bodies when knowing each other in the biblical sense. We'd stone sinners who talk with their mouths full. Eating dessert before your vegetables would be an abomination. Since we spend more time eating than we do flinging DNA, shouldn't we care more about regulating how people eat than how they uck? What's the obsession with other people's sexual behavior? More often than not, of those two behaviors, eating is done most publicly. It has the greater potential impact on others. Public eaters chew with mouths open and force us to see it. Those who talk while eating sometimes get their half-chewed food on us. Very seldom do you see people going at it like spider monkeys at the mall. And even when they do, it doesn't take long. And you shouldn't be close enough to them that you get anything on you. And it's still more entertaining than that idiot kid with the pizza and fries falling out of his face, or the giggly girl with strawberry milkshake spraying out of her nose. In a sane world, the vendors at the ballparks would sell condoms instead of pretzels. In a sane world, we'd also recognize that we spend far more time sleeping than we spend creating protein puddles. So we'd exercise far more regulatory control over sleeping in bed rather than the non-sleeping behavior in bed. For instance, our social rank would be dependent upon whether we sleep on our backs, on our sides, or on our stomachs. Snoring could result in jail time, or in serious and repeated violations of the snoring ordinance, burning at the stake. After all, we spend hours and hours a day sleeping. If we spent the same amount of time creating friction with our genitals as we spend sleeping, it would look like we had sex with blenders. We'd all be walking funny. We really need to get over this obsession with socially regulating others' genital friction. Isn't it time we stop letting the least imaginative among us decide what our sexual norms are? See you at the mall. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional Institution at Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Insofar as you feel secure doing so, would you introduce yourself or your group and speak about what you/it does?
We're just some anti-fascists in New York City, and we coordinate the annual July 25th International Day of Solidarity with Anti-Fascist Prisoners. We're interested in the European Antifa model with a focus on building a mass movement against fascism with educational and cultural strategies rather than just a fighting crew. We believe in a diversity of tactics and that there is all kinds of work to be done, only some of which involves outright violence. Fascism threatens all of us, and we want to engage more people in doing anti-fascist work, period. We aren't an ideological party with specific lines on every issue. Our work is very pragmatic and focuses on fascist and white nationalist groups, especially fascist recruiting attempts in the countercultural music scenes and supporters clubs, as well as matches, cross-recruiting of left-wing and anarchist political movements. We're also interested in fascist groups, such as Third Positionist and the Rock Against Communism, RAC, Skinheads, which contain people of color, because there is no shortage of them in New York City. We even have a black neo-Nazi here who is apparently part of the NSM, the National Socialist Movement. We're also interested in fascist immigrant groups such as Golden Dawn, as well as the new wave of LGBTQ white nationalists such as Jack Donovan and Milo Yiannopoulos. We highlight immigrant and refugee rights, as well as opposition to structural racism, especially the NYPD's role in racial profiling and murdering unarmed people of color like Eric Garner and Akai Gurley.
Will you first talk a bit about the July 25th Day of Solidarity with anti-fascist prisoners? How did it begin, and what are the intentions behind it? Will you also touch on the fact that it is more of a global initiative this year?
In 2013, we were asked to participate in a call for solidarity actions with Jock Pal Freeman, but we were too busy to make it happen. Jock is an Australian man who is doing a 20-year sentence in Bulgaria. He had defended two Romani men who were being attacked by a gang of fascist football hooligans, and in the scuffle, one of them died. That guy ended up being the son of a national politician, and in a sham trial, Jock got convicted of murder. So he's in prison in Sofia, but is politically active and has even organized the Bulgarian Prisoners Association to advocate for prisoners' rights. His case has attracted national attention in Australia, partly because Bulgaria is refusing to allow him to serve his sentence near his family unless they pay an exorbitant fee. In 2014, we decided to make a call for solidarity with Jock, whose case is not well known in the U.S. The Torch Network, formerly the Anti-Racist Action Network, helped us with this. The response was pretty good, and there were events in the U.S., Canada, Australia, Britain, and the Netherlands. While working on this, we realized that while there were many anti-fascist prisoners around the world, there was no central clearinghouse for information about them or day of action specifically for them. So we developed our global anti-fascist prisoner list and transferred the day into one for all Antifa prisoners. In 2015, there were events in Britain, the United States, Finland, Australia, Germany, Sweden, and Bulgaria. This year, we were a little overwhelmed, partly because of the increase in fascist activity. But after the arrests in Atlanta and Anaheim, we knew there were going to be a new wave of prisoners in the U.S., and more were coming in Europe, too. We knew we had better renew the call. In the week after the call, the Brexit vote unleashed a wave of hate crimes in Britain, and the Sacramento mass stabbings happened at the Antifa demo there. We've also become more and more aware of the fascist movement in throughout Latin America, as well as Indonesia, Malaysia, Mongolia, Japan, etc. We want to build stronger connections with the anti-fascist movements there and turn this truly into a decentralized project of international solidarity. Last year, people made translations on their own, and we linked to them, whereas this year, we consciously commissioned them, including into Bahasa, Indonesia, Japanese, and Tagalog, a language in the Philippines, so that the call would be amplified outside North America and Europe. In turn, if Antifa are arrested in these countries, we'll be ready to provide solidarity from North America and Europe.
It has seemed that people have been getting increasingly mobilized in many directions recently with the current political climate in this country. Will you speak a bit on the current state of fascism in the U.S.? Can you speak to the things that anti-fascists might expect to encounter from fascists?
Trump's candidacy has poured gasoline on the U.S. fascist movement. So we're facing a possible President Trump, plus a whole series of far-right movements like the Islamophobes, anti-immigrant movements, the militias, and Patriot Movement, and the men's rights movement. And then we have the real white nationalist and fascist movement, which is more diverse than it was in the past. It's cross-class, and even in some cases has people of color involved. There are now more intellectual groups in addition to the regular Nazi skinhead and prison gangs. The, quote, alternative right is attracting younger, hipper, and more media-savvy racists. Part of the movement are starting to welcome LGBTQ people. It's in a full swing like we haven't seen since the last big wave petered out after 1995. Trump has made fascists clearly feel emboldened to take the streets openly. In the past, local police have been very aggressive in separating fascists and anti-fascists at demonstrations. This was not the case in a number of West Coast clashes, however. And in both Anaheim and Sacramento, the Klan and Nazis did not hesitate to stab Antifa, many of whom were not prepared for this. So I think if you're organizing a demo, you should be aware of both possibilities.
Will you give a working definition of fascism? Apart from a dictionary definition, how has this term evolved, or how is it being used nowadays?
People have argued about that question for years. For us, these definitions aside, fascism is an actual political movement, just like anarchism or environmentalism is. You can see it move and change and splinter, and you can track the ideologies on participants. You don't need to define it in order to see it, track it, and counteract it. As long as groups are engaged in politics which promote white supremacy or white separatism, they should be treated like fascists. We also don't think you need to get caught up in labeling a group as fascist in order to organize against it. People wasted a lot of time arguing if Trump was a fascist or not, but does it matter if he fits someone's own definition or if he's just a racist populist? What matters is what he's going to do and how we're going to react to it.
Are there any current anti-fascist initiatives, apart from this Day of Solidarity, that you'd like to shed light on?
In one interview, the leader of the Sacramento Stabbers, Matthew Heimbach of the Traditionalist Worker Party, say that they have canceled their plans to come to the Cleveland RNC and instead are coming to New York City on July 30th. We're still trying to figure out if they're actually going to do what they say. They seem to often chicken out, but if they do, you should come. We would also like folks to be aware of Antifa International's International Anti-Fascist Defense Fund. That's at intlantifadefense.wordpress.com/about-2. They provide funds for prisoners, injured anti-fascists, and other instances. They also have a program where you can set up your credit card up for $5 a month to support the fund.
Would you feel okay giving some suggestions on activities that people can include if they choose to organize a day of solidarity in their town?
We encourage people to take the idea and make it their own and relate it to the issues of most concern to them. Folks have held letter writing benefits, concerts, dinners, talks, shown movies, done banner drops, flyered at festivals, gone wheat pasting, made solidarity photos and videos, issued statements, painted graffiti, and held demonstrations. Rose City Antifa is doing their Postcards to Prisoners project again this year. They ask people to write postcards and send or tweet them pictures of the cards, which they post on social media. You're welcome to add other prisoners in who are not on our list that you would like to support or twin it with other issues that are important to you. If you live in an area without an event, just take some time to write a prisoner a postcard or a letter. It can really mean a lot to them.
Where can people learn more information about this event?
Our call for the July 25th International Day of Solidarity with Anti-Fascist Prisoners, as well as the Global Anti-Fascist Prisoner List, is at nycantifa.wordpress.com. We have translations of the call up in Spanish, Russian, French, German, Bahasa, Indonesia, Greek, Finnish, Japanese, Tagalog, and Swedish. And Polish is coming. You can also follow us on Twitter at NYC Antifa, and we'll be posting local events that are planned and updates, of course. And now here's that conversation with Keep Hoods Yours.
Thanks for tuning in. This is Doug in the West Coast office. We're joined here today for a very important interview with a participant in the graffiti crew Keep Hoods Yours, also known as KHY, out here in the Bay Area. Well, first off, let's talk about what is a graffiti crew for those people listening that may know nothing about graffiti culture. What is it and how does it operate?
Well, it varies from crew to crew, but for the most part, a graffiti crew is generally a semi-formal grouping of graffiti writers that have similar styles, aesthetic choices, and philosophy towards the craft. The group, in order to be able to collaborate on doing graffiti, to exchange styles, knowledge, strategy, and supplies, and to generally have each other's backs. Since it's a culture that's rooted in the streets, anything can happen, and it being illegal, we can't really rely on mainstream institutions to solve conflicts. But it varies. For some crews, they're just drinking buddies. For others, they're very serious, formal, tight-knit, and organized. It definitely varies.
I guess the first thing people would think of when they think of a graffiti crew is they think it's automatically connected with a gang or something like that.
It's actually not. It's often the other way around, actually. Especially in working-class neighborhoods, some youth do graffiti instead of falling into gang traps. In some cities, gangs and graffiti crews get along or just don't beef, while in other cities it's much different. With some crews, there's overlap with gang affiliations and graffiti, but for the most part, they're two very different, separate worlds that sometimes conflict.
So sense of place seems pretty central to the idea of KHY. Can you tell some of our listeners about, generally speaking, the upbringing of many of the people involved in the group? What do you think drove them to become involved in KHY? And, you know, what kind of drives people to be engaged in this activity, which could be potentially legally dangerous?
All the people involved in this project at this time are born and raised in the Bay Area. Part of what's driven folks to become involved with KHY has just been seeing the blatant gentrification, police violence, and other problems in our neighborhoods, and also seeing how liberal nonprofit efforts at changing these things fail repeatedly. These efforts usually alienate a lot of folks in the hood, who are then probably attracted to something like KHY, because they see it as a way to be able to engage with the oppressive things going on in their environment without limiting themselves to reformist legal means. It is potentially dangerous, but the reality for folks is that the problems they're dealing with are already dangerous. They face a larger danger from losing people in their community to police violence, to gentrification, to having families being split apart, to the erasure of their culture and loss of dignity that comes with it, that kind of thing. So really, the risk of catching a misdemeanor case for writing on a wall, it doesn't feel all that dangerous compared to our daily reality.
And let's just talk specifically now about KHY. How and when did it form, and overall, what are its goals? And also, as both a radical project and a graffiti crew, and how did it evolve over time since it first started?
KHY formed in about 2008, 2009 with just a couple of us, and it's grown over time. It's grown at a much faster rate in the past 3 years or so. It's really just a graffiti crew that's rooted in radical ideas, including anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian, and anti-colonial thought. KHY aims to highlight the anti-property values of graffiti culture by exploring how targeted graffiti application can be used as a form of direct action, while also using culture like radical youth cultures and community organizing to help develop an antagonistic, decentralized, popular culture of resistance that can hopefully develop our capacity to identify and attack the various forces which exploit poor and working class spaces, including gentrification, police violence, rape culture, and local white supremacist and fascist efforts.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. And let's talk about what kind of campaigns that you all have been involved in. To me, the first thing that pops up in my mind is Locals Corner. And that obviously wasn't something that was necessarily started by you guys, but something that you were involved in. And if you could just talk a little bit about that, the background of that. Locals Corner was, it's closed down now, but it was a restaurant in the Mission District. And also, you all are involved right now in a campaign around Fast Agent. So if you could just talk to us a little bit about what those were and why you chose those things as targets.
The Locals Corner campaign, it was just a very obvious example of the blatant colonial white supremacist mentality behind some of the gentrifiers in the Mission District. For folks who don't really know the story behind it, it involves an owner refusing to seat people of color. There was one specific incident where they denied a Latina mother and her kids a table, claiming there weren't enough seats, and then sat down a group of customers of the same size right after. And another incident where some local students carried out a test where they had a group of white students come in and they were given seating. Then another group of students of color came in and they were denied seating. Yeah, and there was already a lot of local anger at that business, but the mainstream liberal attempts to hold them accountable were failing. Folks had a petition floating around, they had small protests, but none of that really put enough pressure alone on Locals Corner to do anything. KHY targeting Locals Corner was the tipping point for their business. The bad publicity along with the mainstream legal pressure, and then on top of that, the repeated vandalism, which became popularized as other folks who were not involved with KHY in any way began replicating the strategy and targeting it themselves, was just the final straw. And they closed, they called it. We did that to show that direct action can be accessible to folks who don't feel as familiar with it, you know. It doesn't necessarily need to involve a high-risk action like burning something down, and it can be creative, accessible, less of a risk than folks assume, and it can be effective. It can shut things down. You can make a gentrifying business get the f*** out of your neighborhood.
I don't know, I would assume for younger people that would be like a big tipping point. They say like, wow, we actually shut this thing down, and like other avenues just didn't do anything.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people saw that. Even some of the liberal folks gave credit. They said that KHY had a lot to do with it and that they wouldn't have closed without our efforts. And I think it legitimized direct action and more militant, illegal tactics in the eyes of the community because it was effective. It was a small victory, but people were glad to see them leave. It also engaged a lot of folks who had never been involved in direct action before. Once other graffiti writers and people in their neighborhood began vandalizing it, writing messages, their names, just scribbling over it, whatever, they became engaged in that process. They were able to build their confidence at attacking what essentially attacks them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also interesting in, like, with the fast agent thing, which is basically it's ads that are on bus stop benches. Because I see it as you all are kind of like picking something in the social landscape, kind of like saying, like, you know, get this.
Definitely. I mean, it's essentially what graffiti has always been about. It's always been a battle for the public visual landscape. There's something inherently very antagonistic, anti-property and anti-capitalist about graffiti. So Fast Agent is an advertising campaign for the real estate agent who has the highest record for flipping properties in the neighborhoods being targeted by gentrification, the number one real estate agent in the East Bay. His name is Kenny Chong, and he also, like Locals Corner, already faced a lot of resentment from the locals. He wasn't very strategic about it either. He did a lot of talking to people online and instigating and being really condescending to folks. And part of that entitlement was him blasting West Oakland and parts of East Oakland with these fast agent ads to take up space and show his presence to assert his economic power. So we started targeting him and encouraging other folks to do so. At this point, it's been our campaign that's had the widest participation out of any other. I mean, there's been hundreds of other people from all walks of life who have tagged on them, vandalized them, ripped them out, far more than we ever did. It's normalized, decentralized, has a life of its own now, and has little to do with us. And again, it goes to show you that you don't have to necessarily be a part of a group or organization. You don't have to go through legal means or follow the law. You don't have to wait for anything. You can just take resistance in your own. You can just take resistance into your own hands, at your own pace, even if you're isolated and even if you don't want to be a part of anything formal. And at this point, it's been going on for over a year.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that was that long.
Yeah, it's been over a year at this point.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, if people are going to look at KHY stuff, primarily they do that through Instagram, you know, if it isn't on the street. So how do you find engaging over social media? Have you been able to build relationships with other people and other projects through this? And also, like, what is it like using social media as a means to, you know, show people what the crew is doing, but at the same time, obviously, the police, you know, can use that as a means to surveil?
So far, social media has really just been a means to highlight some of our ideas about resistance to folks that aren't already involved in radical circles. Folks that are already radicalized, they are already involved in radical movements, don't need social media to be involved to get informed. So the social media thing was really meant as a way to just engage folks in the hood that were on social media anyways. So far, it has helped build some solidarity. We've reached out to folks in other cities across the West Coast, the U.S., even in other countries. Just as far as exchanging some inspiration, news, strategy, ideas, just making those connections between similar struggles in all these different cities. There's been a lot of sharing, too. Folks will send us photos of them doing politicized graffiti in their cities, of things that are going on in other places. We've had folks in Mexico use politically targeted graffiti application and send us reports about it, stuff like that. Now that we've got a pretty strong social media presence, we focus more on highlighting other struggles that might be more isolated. It's also helped to build some relationships that have materialized in real life, like outside of social media. There's definitely limitations to using a medium like social media that's always surveilled. But in reality, only very specific things are communicated through Instagram. Most of the photos that we post about Fast Agent, for example, like 95% of it come from folks who have nothing to do with KHY. At this point, it's more about documenting recent and current struggles. At most, there's just pictures of KHY graffiti. Unfortunately, social media has sort of become part of graffiti culture. There's hella accounts documenting graffiti, and it's just not as hot as other forms of direct action.
Because you hear all the time, like, horror stories about somebody goes and steals a bunch of paint, and then their next picture is, like, their job, and the police go to their job and arrest them or something like that.
Yeah, but in the Bay Area, graffiti is just so widespread and so ingrained out here that it's so easy to get away with it that they're not really prosecuting graffiti in the same way they would in some small town. And if you're not prepared to deal with the potential consequences, you shouldn't even be doing it.
Yeah.
Is that something that you all think about too? Because it's like, it's not just so much that it's like it's everywhere, but it's like integrated into the landscape. Like it's, you know, it's murals, it's advertisement, like graffiti is part of, you know, not only like working class communities, but also in some ways like capital itself. Like, I guess, what does it mean to be a graffiti artist, but also like want to make that like a radical kind of activity?
Well, most of the time, graffiti isn't explicitly radical or political, but it is inherently, and that's what we're trying to highlight. We're trying to highlight that this culture and that a lot of youth from all walks of life participate in is already inherently radical. It already has revolutionary potential, and folks that are engaged in this culture already have the tools necessary to carry out resistance. People do graffiti every day. People do graffiti on everything, anything. All it takes is strategic placement and, if desired, some messaging, and it becomes a form of direct action.
Well, that kind of brings it to our next question, but has the politics of KHY affected other street organizations or graffiti crews that are kind of like in this general area? And have the stance that you all have taken pushed people in the graffiti scene in a more political direction, or has it already just been going that way because of the gentrification and police violence in San Francisco and Vary?
As far as other street organizations and other crews, there's been a lot of mutual respect. Our goals have kept us out of the usual, often petty conflicts that exist in graffiti, and that's given us a lot of room to be able to focus on what we're doing. We're not engaged in the usual beef dynamics in graffiti politics, even those which some of us might have been involved in before. We're more interested in exploring potentials for unity, collaboration, and focusing on common enemies, and for the most part, other writers see this and respect it, or just leave it alone. We're also not pushovers and have our own histories out here that some people are aware of. Graffiti was beginning to take a slightly more political direction in the Bay Area, but it was very minor. Graffiti is full of problematic people and oppressive behaviors, and so we've helped to push local graffiti in a little more of a political direction as far as people becoming more involved, as far as people becoming strategic about what they do graffiti on, about what they paint, and also about bringing up dynamics in the culture. How folks carry themselves, solidarity, things like that. Calling out rape culture and misogyny, highlighting different issues that affect writers. There's a drug addiction epidemic in graffiti that's hard to talk about and has cost a lot of heavy hitters and good people. We're definitely trying to radicalize graffiti writers while using graffiti to radicalize folks that don't do graffiti.
Do you, like, when you all have engaged in that, do you feel like there's some pushback? Because I would just imagine you're kind of like, you know, people like that kind of political stance is almost like seen as like a cliche. I feel like whenever you bring that stuff up in any sort of youth subculture, you know, like people just like, I don't care about that. Like, it's just about destroying and that's what it is.
The only pushback we've really felt is a few misogynistic individuals who feel threatened by us highlighting a lot of predators in the Bay Area and calling out rape culture and being really explicit about that. It's almost unheard of for a graffiti crew, for a project that mostly consists of males in a culture that's male-dominated, to explicitly call for fighting patriarchy and pushing rapists out of their scenes and spaces in a militant way.
Yeah, that in itself is pretty crazy because, I mean, graffiti has just historically been so male-dominated.
Yeah, so really, that's been most of the pushback. As far as our broader politics with this project, there hasn't been too much of a pushback because we were actually graffiti writers in the first place. We're not people who aren't a part of graffiti and just trying to use graffiti to reach out to youth or whatever. We are already graffiti vandals. We have styles. We have history. We have legitimacy. We have these relationships already. And now we're choosing to use our momentum to try to radicalize the culture and folks that have access to it. All of our campaigns have been about things that are blatantly a problem locally and that most people relate to regardless. People are already mad about them. We don't really deal with abstract political concepts. We're not out here putting out academic rants and things like that. We're challenging what people are already well aware of: police murdering people, rape culture, gentrification, the recent rise in white supremacist organizing in the Bay Area. These are problems that people are already pissed about.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about the rebellion in the Bay Area against white supremacy and police violence in late 2014 in a second. But I just wanted to ask, you know, we were talking about social media, but do you see, like, would there be any interest to create, like, a KHY magazine or something, like, in print, like, something basically off the internet? Obviously, there's, like, in this canvas that's online. I don't know what you think of that, but that's kind of, like, trying to do somewhat of a political stance on graffiti. But how do you feel about basically, like, graffiti zines or magazines or publications or anything else that's like outside of social media.
Even though social media has helped reach a broader audience, we understand that it's pretty limited and temporary. We started working on a zine project, which should hopefully be coming out soon.
Well, that's awesome to hear. I know there's a lot of graffiti nerds out there that are rubbing their ears together. But so let's talk a little bit about in fall of 2014, in the wake of Darren Wilson basically being let off for the killing of Michael Brown Jr. in Ferguson. There was a series of riots that erupted in the Bay Area, and graffiti writers, in my opinion, played a huge role in that rebellion. Can you talk about the experience you thought overall of the members of KHY within that revolt? How did this affect the crew in general? And how do you feel like the revolt changed people, especially those that were kind of like new either to, you know, quote, political action or anything like that?
There were some folks involved in this project that were out in the streets. These demonstrations had a positive, energizing effect on most of the youth who came out. The revolt was very empowering for most people. For a lot of newly radicalized folks to feel that power, to be able to hold space in the street, to be able to push back cops, to target things that they disagree with or don't want in their neighborhoods, within the protection of a larger crowd. I think it also helped to reestablish radical politics within local youth cultures. You saw a lot of cultures being represented. You saw graffiti writers painting while there were riots in the background. You saw musicians, skateboarders, dancers, etc. A lot of the revolt was very youth-led, very youth-involved. I think it was successful in bringing a lot of people out into the streets, being radical and having fun.
I mean, to me, it was just like I was telling people from out of town. I said, you know, I feel like the graffiti writers are kind of like the Bay Area version of kind of like the soccer hooligans in Egypt. You know, they were kind of like played this kind of central role. And I feel like it seems like a lot of the media, even the radical media, kind of like overlooked that. And it was really interesting to just see like people writing everywhere on a lot of different things.
Yeah, graffiti writers were definitely out during the revolt. And so many people do graffiti now, it's just so widespread. A lot of graffiti crews were out during that. Your comparison of graffiti writers to soccer hooligans as an antagonistic cultural force is a good one. It's interesting that that dynamic isn't highlighted much.
And to our next question, can you talk about the recent sideshows that have taken place in East Oakland? And you may want to talk about what is a sideshow for people listening that have no idea what that is. And KHY's reaction to the police murder of Richard Perkins, who was killed outside of a sideshow in East Oakland, California. And moreover, what is your view of sideshows in general?
Well, sideshows are a long-standing tradition in Oakland, and they're essentially car shows in the street where folks hold space in the street and perform stunts with their cars. They do donuts, things like that. It's like an outdoor moving car sport party. They're a rebellious, self-organized activity of the working class and have a lot of valuable dynamics. In East Oakland, there's not a lot for the youth to do, and we all know that there's violence, drugs, all that. And these shows help alleviate some of the anxiety, depression, and alienation that come with living through all that. Sideshows are empowering because they give youth something to do in the streets collectively, where they get to feel ownership over the streets that they live in while having fun and be rebellious. They're unique because they're decentralized. They're organized without permits or without any formal hierarchy or leaders, and they easily and quickly gather a lot of people. They're militant and very anti-police. When police come by, they either don't get taken seriously or they're literally attacked. And often sideshows don't end until the participants want them to. Bottles get thrown at them. If they catch a lone cop, windows are getting smashed, hoods are getting stomped. Sideshows are usually so big that police can't get to the center of the sideshow because of all the cars that are taking up the streets for a few blocks. I mean, some of them have hundreds and hundreds of participants. There's strong solidarity and a sense of unity when cops show up. Folks don't snitch on each other and try to avoid internal violence. Sideshows have an insurrectionary potential. They're often accompanied by graffiti, general public rebellion, and sometimes riots. People are militant and often armed. These shows are very fluid and flexible, being able to move from hood to hood, from city to city very efficiently. Some folks involved in this project are a part of sideshow and car culture in the Bay. Some of us were around, just keeping it lit, kicking it, when Richard Perkins was murdered. Everyone saw the murder of Richard Perkins as police retaliation for a nonstop weekend of huge sideshows that the police could not control. And for attacks on a couple of police cars also. Everyone saw that as a way of them trying to assert their dominance over Oakland and to scare folks into going back home. The police lied as always. They always do. They claim that he randomly drove up to them and pulled out a gun on them. A fake gun at that. Everyone knows that's not true. He was at a sideshow having fun. He was not going to randomly run up to cops and pull out a fake gun on them. This isn't the first time this has happened in Oakland, where the pigs say that somebody pulled out a fake gun on them and so they had to shoot them. Some are thinking that it may be easier for the state to frame people in Oakland with fake guns that you can't trace. People were at the scene when the cops shot him. They said that he wasn't doing anything and that once he was shot down, they saw the cops kicking him, moving his body around carelessly. It's just blatant white supremacist state violence. It was in response to the lawlessness of the sideshows and how they made the police look like they didn't have any control. Especially with an increasingly gentrified Oakland, the police are really trying to kill that culture and repress it. It's really just repression.
Collective punishment.
Yeah.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit. Can you talk about the kind of support the KHY has gotten, specifically from the Mission District, but also the Bay Area in general? I mean, I've seen a lot of different articles and stuff being written, kids holding up KHY stickers and stuff like that. Can you talk about, I mean, because it is kind of impressive that KHY has gotten sort of a notoriety within, you know, the Bay Area and the Mission District specifically for a kind of a taboo activity, so to speak. And can you talk about this positive feedback, but also the negative perceptions as well?
I think the support really comes from the fact that, again, our campaign and the issues that we've been addressing are things that a lot of people in our hoods already care about. And this moment is kind of a downtime for radical struggles in the Bay Area. So a lot of responses to police murders, gentrification, etc., have mostly been dominated by liberal ideology and pacified nonsense, which folks are alienated from and can see that it usually brings no kind of results. It feels like a slap in the face when the only response to someone in your hood being executed by racist pigs is so-called peaceful protest, in which every detail is so micromanaged that the lame-ass protest security in yellow vests is staring at you because the message on your sign you're holding is too militant. The fact that we've been engaged in struggles that people are feeling hopeless about in a refreshing, creative way while bringing a militant and radical ideology to the forefront definitely has to do with the support we have, despite using a taboo activity. We haven't really had any negative reactions, aside from folks who obviously wouldn't be down with our project, like yuppies and cop apologists and the occasional whining, delusional liberals, but who cares about them? At first we thought that we'd be accused of being a gang, but that hasn't happened much. Most folks are just actually excited to see graffiti writers use creative application to inspire the community and educate folks by discussing revolutionary ideas. They usually aren't highlighted by the existing liberal left, while also creatively targeting things in the community that everyone hates, whether it be banks, gentrifier businesses, corporations, cop cars, crossing out white supremacist graffiti, the sort of things within the public landscape for all to see, showing that they aren't untouchable.
So you mentioned that a couple times. Can you just touch on that? White power graffiti in San, you know, in the Bay Area?
Historically, there hasn't been. Aside from the obvious established white supremacy that's inherent in the settler state, an open, public white supremacist movement in the Bay Area for various reasons. Possibly in relation to gentrification and all these newcomers from other places, there's been an obvious rise in white supremacist graffiti. Whether it be swastikas, white power, anti-black messages, anti-Mexican messages, etc. So, we decided that was a very easy thing to gather support for targeting, and it's something that can bring folks together around a common enemy. Despite differences in the community and conflicts and divisions, everyone can agree that we don't want Nazis. We don't want white supremacists. And by us taking the initiative to start crossing out those messages, we've inspired other folks to do so. So now all kinds of people, even those that don't do graffiti, are buying markers and crossing out these messages where they see them. It's empowering people to take matters into their own hands instead of waiting on the liberals or police to do something. They're engaging with that on their own, because they should, because these are their streets and their struggles.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned like the Bay Area is kind of in a downtime. You all have really continued to push since the revolt in late 2014. Can you talk a little bit about like the kind of different organizing things you guys have done, different community outreach events? And just talk more a little bit about, as you were saying, like the need to kind of like build in these down moments. And like, this is kind of like where a lot of the work needs to be done in these moments.
That's another main focus of this project. to use culture and community organizing to help those ideas actually materialize in our neighborhoods. We can't just wait for the next uprising or the next series of riots. We can't just wait for the next police murder and hope that this will be the one that will trigger an uprising. In the meantime, between these peak points and struggle, we need to be doing cultural resistance and building collective capacity. We need to be establishing and normalizing radical thinking within the cultures that make up our communities. We need to be educating and learning from each other. We need to be building relationships, meeting each other, strengthening those relationships, building trust so that when there are peak points in the struggle again, when folks are in the streets, they'll already have stronger relationships, trust, and recognize each other. And through this cultural work, this grassroots work, we're also able to bring in new folks and branch out of these closed circles of radicals. We don't need to wait for peak points and struggles. Oppression is always there. Exploitation is always there. Alienation is always there. So even if there's nothing going on, or if you're isolated, or if the city you live in doesn't have a very established radical movement of any kind, anyone can grab a marker or a spray can and go target and challenge things in their neighborhood that are problematic, spread ideas, and creatively take back public space.
Well, I'm really curious what you think the possibilities for bringing radical politics into, as you said, like cultural things, but I'm thinking specifically youth culture, from hip hop to graffiti to punk to motorcycle crews to sports to anything. I mean, what kind of advice would you give to anybody that's looking to kind of like to do this style of activity? It doesn't even have to be graffiti, but something culturally oriented that doesn't really kind of have the auspices already of like political activity.
I think it's very possible to bring radical politics into more traditional forms of youth culture. Most of these cultures already have inherently antagonistic aspects, but it needs to be done in a way that carries legitimacy. It needs to be done by folks that are already participants in these cultures. It's hella see-through when folks who aren't a part of the culture or haven't put in the work, time, risk, energy, etc., pop their heads into said culture and try to use it to make politics cool or something. It comes off as corny, opportunistic, and insincere. I think it's really up to those who are already part of these cultures to bring radical perspectives into them. We're actually graffiti writers in the first place, so we're able to maneuver in a way that allows us to reach a lot of people while remaining authentic and rooted in real graffiti.
So for anybody that's listening to this that is involved in graffiti specifically, and they are like, wow, this is great, you know, I have these political ideas, I'm into graffiti, is there any advice you would give them to form something like KHY in their own towns or cities?
Just do it. Do it. You already have the tools, skills, and desires to do graffiti, and you're already pulling it off. Just think about placement, strategy, what's important to you, and see if anyone else is down. That's our point, that it's really that easy.
Because I think that's a really key point that you hit on, is like finding targets that people already know are like this huge bone of contention, and I feel like that kind of thinking and strategy is something that's often missing. You want to just tell people how they can get a hold of KHY stuff online, where they can go on Instagram and other places?
Yeah, folks can check us out at KeepHoodsYours on Instagram, or just run into us in the streets. Shout out to all of our Bay Area people in the struggle and all the vandals putting paint where it ain't, keeping it rooted in the streets.
To end out the show, we will hear Another Night in Hell by Worm off of their 2016 release, Nights in Hell. They hail from South Florida. Next, we'll hear the band Three Parallel Lines from Italy with Line 2 off of Lines and Lands, also released in 2016.
Thank you.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you are free to do so. Just send us an email so we know that you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website at firestorm.coop.